as a deity, who use the truth as a shield. There is no bullet that can kill the truth when you defend it with reason. So let's join together to end this evil madness that we all call racism, both here and there.
Good afternoon, and welcome to our Street Heat Show. This is our monthly celebration of the struggle for workers' rights and social justice. I'm your host, Pam Whalen. Mike Rhodes is on the controls, and we have two really hot topics today. We're going to be talking in a few minutes. We're going to be talking about the fate of the Fulton Mall. We all know that that Mayor Swearingen is really anxious to bring the wrecking ball down there and get rid of it. And so there's been some twists and turns recently, and we're going to be getting an update on that. Later in the show, we're going to be talking about the hundreds of tenants who are without any kind of gas service, and that includes heating, cooking, showers, the whole thing that is at Somerset Apartments, which is also something that the mayor obviously has had a big hand in terms of decimating the code enforcement department down at City Hall. But we're going to start right now with her vision for Fresno without a Fulton Mall. We have with us, joining with us today, is Ray McKnight. He's the former chair of the Downtown Fresno Coalition. Welcome, Ray.
Thank you.
And we also have Doug Richard, who was the co-chair of the Downtown Fresno Coalition. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, I don't know who wants to start. Maybe, Ray, you want to start. Tell us, we've been hearing, this has been going on for probably a year or so, that the mayor has been on this mission to get rid of, to rid us of this horrible burden, the Fulton Mall. And we have some new twists and turns. So can you kind of update us?
Well, to begin with, the mayor has been dedicated to getting rid of the Fulton Mall since she came into office. So I think that's more like 6 years, isn't it? And the struggle, as I call it, to preserve the mall actually goes back to 2002, when there was one of the first plans, proposals for turning the mall into a street. Well, about recent developments, actually, Doug's probably better about this, but I'll start and he can join me. One development we hope people are aware of is that our organization, the Downtown Fresno Coalition, has two lawsuits to try to stop this, both having to do with what we think were inadequate environmental studies to justify destroying the mall, which is acknowledged as a historical resource. And so we had one lawsuit involving CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act. That's kind of the state level. We lost that to begin with, but we are now appealing that decision. And then we have a federal lawsuit involving the National Environmental Protection Act and other legal protections for historic resources. And so that federal lawsuit is going on. So that's one development. Very recently, the other development that we're very interested in, we want people to be aware of, is that the city invited bids for what they were calling the Fulton Mall Reconstruction Act. I've been calling it the Fulton Mall Destruction Act. And three bids came in, which were all some millions, quite a few million dollars above what was their construction estimate. And the city staff, in a document that we still have a copy of, recommended that all three bids be rejected. And then, strangely, about something like 2 weeks later, the city staff reversed itself and recommended that the lowest bid be accepted, with some changes in the amount, but it was something quite a few million dollars above that construction estimate. I think I'll let Doug take over from this point.
Okay.
Yeah.
So where we are right now, to follow up with Ray, is The city staff is recommending that the city council this Thursday approve a contract with American Paving for the Fulton Mall reconstruction project at $22 million in change, basically $2 million over what the mayor had said the project was going to cost, no more than $20 million, but now it's at $22. This is in addition to already deleting the what is called an additive alternatives. It's kind of like if you're in home and you build a home and you want granite tile, but it's too expensive, you can have the tile not put in and have a cheaper thing put in, and that help lower the cost. Well, the mayor had about $600,000 in these additive alternates or adults that are not going to be put in. And one concern is, in this desire to bring the price down to the $20 million that she promised, things that are going to get cut, the city is going to have to pay for later. And, of course, a lot of our concern is in regards to the art, that if you want a city, the city wants a street, there's only so much you can cut. You have to have a certain amount of asphalt. You have to have a certain amount of cement. You have to have curbs, street paints. Well, the art is one thing that can be quite easily left out and still have your street. And obviously that's one of our concerns. The city has repeatedly said that it's within the scope of the project, but this project has repeatedly changed over the summer. Things that were added, the requests for information were numerous. Right now they've already eliminated their ad alts that they had planned, and there's still $2 million over. What are they going to cut? That's definitely a concern that Fresnans should be worried about, because, like I say, not only are you going to be missing something, but things that are needed, like parking meters, water fountains, signs, are being cut right now. That means they're going to come out of the general fund later.
Okay, and tell us a little bit, Ray, about kind of what's the history of the mall. And, you know, to me, I mean, I you know, go down to the mall quite a bit. I know there are obviously quite a few people in Fresno who don't go to the Fulton Mall very often and maybe are unaware of what's there. So talk a little bit about what is there and what...
That's kind of the beginnings of the...
Yeah, and a little bit of history about the mall.
Well, right, because, we really think it's important that people understand this. So why was the Fulton Mall constructed in the first place? Well, it was because Fulton Street had been the retail center of Fresno, and I think really the region, was starting to fail as a retail center, because Fig Garden Village and Manchester Mall had been built in the mid-late 50s. So businesses were moving away from Fulton Street, and shoppers were moving away from Fulton Street, and the city administration and merchants decided they needed to try to do something to reverse that trend, and that's when they brought in a very famous architect, Victor Gruen, asked him to come up with a plan for, in a sense, redesigning the downtown. But his view was that a pedestrian mall would be the centerpiece of that new plan for downtown Fresno. And he had been thinking. He by the way, was given credit for inventing the shopping center, the type we usually think of. And he had kind of changed his thinking and thought we got to do something about you might say the tyranny of the Alto, and so he engaged Garrett Egbo, who was already a world famous landscape architect, to design this pedestrian mall to replace the street, these six blocks or so of downtown. That worked for a while, but unfortunately, city government, city council and such, began to make decisions that allowed this urban sprawl northward and allowed the construction of more shopping centers. The biggest one, of course, came along right away, was Fashion Fair, so forth. So what happened was the construction of Fulton Mall only for a while prevented that decline of the downtown retail center, we might say, and it just continued. So in a sense, the purpose of the Fulton Mall maybe it didn't work out, but our view is it didn't work out because of all these planning decisions, which we call decentralization as opposed to what had been a policy of centralization, trying to preserve a core, an important core for the downtown. So that's what happened. Now, Garrett Ekpo's design of the mall was absolutely astounding. It got worldwide attention because of the way he introduced water features, fountains and such. He introduced a variety of plantings, interesting seating areas, and particularly what came along very important were the sculptures, which actually an important group of Fresno citizens raised over $200,000 to buy this amazing array of about 19 works of sculpture on the mall. And what Ekpo did, there's no denying this, he was creating not just a place for people to come to shop, he was creating an urban park which emphasized the importance of people being able to sit, walk, enjoy the art, enjoy the water features. This is why this work by Garrett Ekpo became recognized as one of the most important, most influential works of mid-century, 20th century landscape architecture. It became, as a whole, a work of art, and it was on that basis that we were able to get the recognition it has received as a historic resource. It was declared eligible for the National Register of Historic Places. National Park Service approved that, and on the basis of that, it became also was listed on the California Register of Historic Resources. So this became, and still is, an important landmark of landscape architecture that's gotten attention. You know, still gets attention in professional books about urban planning and landscape architecture and so forth.
Okay, and you're listening to KFCF Fresno 88.1. You're listening to the Street Heat Show. We're just talking with Ray McKnight, who's just explaining to us about the history of the Fulton Mall, and also Doug Richard. Doug, could you tell us a little bit more about kind of what's at stake here? What are we really looking at in terms of if this moves forward or if we're able to stop it?
Well, quite frankly, we're looking at the loss of a unique historic and cultural asset for Fresno. The Fulton Mall, obviously, even our strongest supporters admit that it's underperforming currently, and we have several reasons why, much different from the city. But there's no doubt that this could be an asset for the area to attract and bring business in and be an attraction in and of itself. We locally have a perfect example of what we're facing. If you remember the old Fresno courthouse, if you've looked at pictures of that, absolutely gorgeous neoclassical design. The dome was recently put up on the Fresno County Fairgrounds. Fortunately, the Cagula family saved that. Just a unique historic asset that was torn down because it had to go. It wasn't safe. It cost too much. It's old. It's got to go. We also have something similar on this Fresno City Fresno City College campus, the old administration building. If you remember the discussion about that, many of the same debates. Well, seismically can't be saved. It's too old. It's inefficient. It costs too much money. Well, at that point in time, people were able to raise up enough outcry, save it. It took a lot longer than people planned, but it has been refurbished. It's in use today. And I challenge anyone to go over there and not be totally impressed by that building. So we're really facing the same type of decision here. Do we have this unique asset and we let destroy, or do we refurbish and renovate it and keep it for not only today but for tomorrow?
Of course, the old administration building, City College is just absolutely, absolutely breathtakingly gorgeous and a wonderful venue for,
exactly,
for cultural events.
Exactly, and it faced, and it needed to be renovated and refurbished just like the Fulton Mall. If you remember, there were bats and just, you know, all sorts of ugly things inside, and it just needed a lot of work. Same thing with the Fulton Mall. Mm-hmm. I mean, any 50-year-old structure needs a periodic maintenance and refurbishment, and the Fulton Mall has not received that. Even your most basic strip mall in central Fresno has been had more repainting work done on it than the Fulton Mall.
Yeah, because a lot of the fountains and stuff are not functioning.
Think any of them are.
I think there might be one at the very, very southern end that is, but many of them are not. Okay, so it's been. I mean, obviously, this thing is like. Trains going down the track, right? It's something that's very important for the mayor. She's going to be out of office pretty soon. So I mean, can the people of Fresno save this? Or is it just something that we're just going to lose, Ray?
Well, a very important vote is coming up. It's December 3rd still,
yes.
Isn't it? The city council. That's when this recommendation we were talking about earlier by the city staff will go before the council. Will they accept that bid and then, and I suppose what's implied, do some kind of trimming, chipping away and trying to get that to work and continue with the plan to destroy them all? So if people are concerned, they need to tell their council members. They need to call them, write them, and maybe even show up at that meeting and let them know. I have kept a record of this since I've been involved in this now for 12 or 13 years. I've kept a record of all the expressions of public support for the mall that goes back, as I said earlier, to 2002. And I don't think there's any question that the preponderance of people in this city, those that hear enough and know something about what's going on, want that mall to be saved. And that's one of the things that we've really started wondering. We've kind of been to toss this question out. Who is it that really wants to get rid of the mall? Who are these people? What are these forces or interests? And I think people ought to start asking that, because our view is, so far as the public benefit, the kind of thing that Doug referred to, the public benefit here is the preservation of that urban park and that place that has aesthetic and cultural historic significance, which if we're properly maintained and promoted, I think could survive and be a viable place, not maybe as the center of all retail, for the whole region, but a place where people will want to come for shopping. And one thing that's being talked about, I think, is very important now, maybe for to eat, for entertainment, if we things of that sort.
And I think another very important element of this discussion that we have to address is that there are people using it right now. There are people that live in the downtown who use it as their park, their safe walkway. There are people that shop down there, and it's the people that aren't represented by the big multi-story office complexes out in North Fresno. And these are the kind of the people that often get put by the wayside. And Fresno historically has been low on parks and of this type of open space. And when you look at it geographically, the southern part of the city especially gets hit hard in this. And they're about to lose another asset for them, for their, you know, walking space is a safe place to take the kids. You know, it's not going to be the same, even if the fountains are there and the artwork is there, like the mayor swears it's going to be there. It's not going to be the same safety to take your kids down there when you have cars and traffic and everything going along there. There are people that use it now.
If I can add something. When I talked about Victor Gruen and his plan, an important part of the Victor Gruen plan was to encourage the construction of a large number of living units, housing in downtown. That never happened. But fortunately, more recently, there have been some of these apartment projects that are bringing more people to live downtown. And so, in a way, there is already some sign that activity in the around the mall, on the mall, is picking up. And so that would be another argument. Let's give it a chance and encourage it, because there's already been maybe a reversal of that neglect and kind of a flight away from the Fulton Mall that happened a couple of decades ago.
Well, and of course, with the high-speed rail in, there's going to be an influx of a lot of activity in that part of town.
Right, yes.
And so if we destroy it, and then it's not going to be there for... Right.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the disingenuous things that the mayor tied into in this project, was she tried to make it a necessary part of the high-speed rail station, which is absolutely a fallacy. For one, she argued that Fulton needed to be reopened so that people could access the high-speed rail station. Well, anybody that lives in Fresno knows you're not going to travel down Fulton to get to the station, which is basically where Tulare is. You're going to use 99 or 41
and
go down
Street.
Fresno or Tulare. And think about it. If you're at the high-speed rail station, it's 10, 15 minutes till your train comes. What would be the ideal thing? Go to a walking pedestrian area right next to Fulton.
Get yourself a hot dog or something.
Exactly. Yeah. You're not going to get in your car and leave your parking place at the station and then go drive down Fulton. That's a total fallacy on that. That's why I stress the fact that it would be a draw. A pedestrian area there would be a draw for the people waiting at the high-speed stations. And if it's, I think it could become such a unique area that people would actually travel along high-speed to visit Fulton, because it is unique.
Okay, let's talk about this this meeting on December 3rd. That's Thursday.
Yes, it's Thursday. It's the city council meeting this Thursday. Now, the Fulton Mall part of the agenda is going to start at 1:30.
At 1:30.
And they will take comments on that at that point in time. If you want to speak, and I hope a lot of people will come down at that point in time and speak out, you'll fill out a comment card, and then they'll call your name and draw comments. You can also contact the city council by mail or phone before that, and I would encourage you to do so. And even if you're uncertain about whether the street or the mall is actually the best idea, this particular project, which they're voting on, is bad. It's over budget. It's going to cost millions of dollars more than planned. It's going to take money away from other things. And it's just, this is a bad project. Even if you think what we're saying is not true, the project itself is a bad project. It doesn't meet the conditions the council actually set in February 2014.
Okay. I guess, what do we know? What do we expect the different city council members to say about this?
Well,
a key vote in the past was on February the 27th, 2014, and that's when the city council voted to accept the Tiger Grant, which is the big, the federal grant, the large sum of money that's a part of this budget. And at that time, the vote was 5-2. So we already had two council members who did not want to go along with this. They're still on the council. And that's why all we need to do is to get two more, and this thing would go down to defeat. So it's not an impossible prospect, I think.
Okay.
And I think if the financial conservatives, the fiscal conservatives on the council, if they take an honest look at this, they'll see that this is exactly the type of project that they rail against. It's gone over budget. It keeps creeping up. It's going to use more money than was budgeted for. And this is, if they have true integrity, they'll say, hey, this is not a good budget. This is not a good project. We have to vote no.
And who are the people that are going to benefit financially from this?
That's a good question, which I think we should be asking the question. My answer is, of course, people that own buildings along the mall, and so often these are outside interests, which I don't know if we can call them all speculators, but I think there's a great hope that they've bought into the notion that if you put a street through the mall, somehow their their property is going to be worth more, and they can sell it off for more. I'm not saying we know they will, but we hear rumors about it. I'll just put it that way.
You know, and I think one of the ironies here is a lot of the businesses that are on the mall right now are going to get crushed by this. The city has no plans for making any transition period for them, helping them get into another location. Their economic argument is that the area is not producing economically. Thus, those businesses that are there now, a lot of them first generation immigrants, working 12, 20 hours a week trying to make it things a go. You know, the city wants them out. It just doesn't care what happens to them. And another little irony in this whole deal is one of the most biggest proponent of this, Craig Sharton, who's been in the road, has a place down there called Peeves, and it's been very successful, and it doesn't have the road in front of it that he demands that is necessary to be successful. So that's kind of a funny catch-22 that I thought on this, and it shows that with the right marketing idea, the right concept, things are successful down there and can be. We just need a broader look on that.
Okay, and I just want to, just remind our listeners that we're talking to Doug Richard, who is the co-chair of the Downtown Fresno Coalition, and Ray McKnight, which is the former chair of the Downtown Fresno Coalition. And we just have a little bit of time left, so I want to kind of focus very, very good on what people can do if they want to save the mall or they want to have any opinion about it. What are the things that they can do, and I guess that's it. Just kind of really very nitty gritty nuts and bolts. What can you do? I'll start with you, Doug.
I think the biggest thing is to contact your council member if you live in a specific district, and if not, if you're a resident of the area but not a specific member, go ahead and call the council and say, listen, I'm a resident of the area, and I think this is a valuable cultural and unique asset worth saving.
Okay.
And there's so many aspects of what is going to happen if this street goes through. All along during this whole process of the effort to approve, to put a street through the mall to destroy it, there were lots of promises made that the art was going to be preserved and so forth. Of course, the sculptures maybe in some way will be moved and placed different. Well, we don't know where they're all going to be placed. They claim they're going to store them and restore them and find places to put them. But people should just think. I just want to dwell on the trees, because we only recently got the plans from the consultants about what would happen to the trees on the mall. And all along there have been the promises that you get a different count of the trees, 140-some, 152, I'm not sure the exact numbers, in that something of that sort. Promises the trees will be replaced. Well, the plans we just got shows that about four-fifths of the trees currently on the mall, these mature trees that provide this canopy of shade, are going to be uprooted, going to be destroyed. Now, they will be replaced, but what kind of replacement? Well, the specifications for the contractors they list these trees, and it talks about a 36-inch box, 48-inch box. That's 3-foot, 4-foot saplings. So you just think about what that's going to look like when all these trees are gone and these little saplings are growing. Now, when the proponents of putting the street through the mall wanted to win people over, they have these very, very beautiful drawings of people walking on the sidewalk by all these cars under a great canopy of trees. Well, how many years is it going to be before those trees mature and provide what the trees at present give us?
Okay, well, we're going to wrap up now.
Okay.
So this is going to be on the City Council agenda at 1:30 this Thursday on December 3rd. And if this is something that you care about, I guess you should be there.
Yes,
come
to the meeting.
Call your council member. Let your voice be heard.
Right, right. Okay, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ray McKnight and Doug Richard from the Downtown Fresno Coalition. Thank you. And
thank
we're
going
to take a brief break now. We're going to come back and talk about what is going on with those hundreds of tenants that are without any kind of gas. They have no heating. It's pretty cold right now, and we're going to have some folks coming in and talking about what is going on with the Somerset apartments and, you know, what's going to be done or has been done or hasn't been done to make sure that this situation is corrected. So we're going to be right back.
I have been here forever underneath the sky, watching the way the clouds whirl all across the land, feeling the wind blowing softly all those summer nights, hearing the sounds that the rain makes when it falls. I have been here forever, counting all the stars, watching the way the rivers flow like shadows to the sea, hearing the birds singing sweetly ancient melodies, hearing the prayers of people to the sun. And
you're listening to the Street Heat Show. I'm your host, Pam Whalen. Mike Rhodes is on the controls, and we're joined in the studio by several folks that are involved with the Somerset Apartments with the crisis there. You may have heard about it, I'm sure, on other media. And we're going to have sort of a different perspective here. And we have Gong Nathadith, who is a tenant. Welcome, Gong. Pahualar, who is an attorney. And also Alexia Kirkland, who is also an attorney with Kirkland Law of California. So why don't we start with you? Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
And why don't we start with you, Gong? Why don't you tell us, you know, like how long you've been in this apartment and what the heck happened?
Well, because when we stayed there, it was kind of the fume, the gasoline.
The gasoline fumes?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. That was just propane, leaking somewhere.
The propane was leaking?
Yes. Uh-huh. But we didn't know.
When was that?
It was beginning of the month. And everybody thought it was just something smell. Real headaches, you know. They asked me, I said, I think I told them it was propane. But it was gasoline. But I didn't for sure.
Okay. And how long have you been at those apartments?
I've been there for a long time and just off and on, go see my daughters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it was not going to affect it. It's just a fume.
Just fumes. So
yeah.
You thought it was just fumes.
Yeah.
But then there was nothing. Right?
Nothing.
Yeah.
It was because everybody was doing a barbecue outside, but it was, could be exploded.
Uh-huh. Oh, so they turned it off.
Yeah, but it was the way it keep going and everybody getting headaches every day.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume my daughter was say it's okay.
So when did they turn it off?
They turned off on Saturday afternoon.
Of this past week?
3 weeks ago.
3 weeks ago.
Yes.
Okay. So kind of describe, what's it like? What's it like to live there at this point without the gas?
Because it's our cultures. We like living with our cultures of peoples. And we didn't have no hot waters. But, you know, it's like, it feel like back home. Like we came back from refugees.
Mm-hmm.
The way we see it, it was kind of why we have to suffer with hot water, no heaters, getting colds, and kids getting sick. Why the manager didn't tell us? If you're everybody getting awkward, you know, if you're the manager didn't tell us why, you know, why.
So did somebody talk to the manager?
Because everybody was getting mad, everybody getting to the circles.
Mm-hmm. Talking about it.
Yeah, talk about it.
So people contacted the management.
Yes, they go ask them what is the reason why we don't get hot waters, why the heat is not here, and a lot of people are getting sick here, getting a lot of old people.
And what did the management say?
Oh, we turn off because the gas leaking. Why didn't our farmers let us know so we could repair, let us know where we can go? Mm-hmm. Instead that we have to suffer, that he said that it's going to be repaired when. But he provide to somebody the illness. How about the kids?
Mm-hmm.
How about the people who got babies? Everybody get blankets, but how about the babies? They don't got no heaters, but the elders get the heaters. Why you didn't tell us that you will provide us the heaters, you know, for the kids?
So has the owner said when the gas is going to be back on?
He didn't, nothing.
Okay, I want to turn to Pahua. So you've jumped in, and I know you've been involved in tenants' law before. So what do you think about this situation?
I want to say, first of all, that myself, Alexia, and another attorney, John Cottawal, I think that's how you say his name, the three of us are working together, and we've been doing tenant issues for a while now. And with this particular situation, there is desperation in the air. That's the only way to describe it. When we first went out there to assess the situation and to speak to tenants and to hear their concerns, because we were invited to do so, it's very clear that the families there are distraught. They are desperate. They don't know what's going on. There is a language barrier, a cultural barrier, and they're cold. They're hungry. They just want hot water and heat at this point. There are other issues that have surfaced that we are aware of in talking to the tenants. We know that there are a lot of habitable conditions that we are very concerned about, even after the heat and the hot water are dealt with. So every tenant that we speak to, it's just different across the board. And again, they're hanging on to every word myself, Alexia, and John has to say, because they're wondering, What's going on? What's happening? Do I have legal rights? And we're trying to meet with as many people as we can. But
so what is the legal situation? What is the obligation of the landlord? And what is the obligation of the city? And where do they stand in all that?
And Alexia, you can jump in at any time, too. We are trying to sort out the issues right now. We know that we have an apartment complex where it's estimated there's about 1,800 people living there. We're talking to tenants who are saying these conditions didn't happen overnight. It's been conditions that folks have lived with for 30 years. We talked to one resident who's been there for 30 years who says, I've been dealing with floods, I've been dealing with mold, I've been dealing with no smoke detector, so a whole host of issues. So we're looking to see who the responsible person is at this point, whether it be the owner, whether it be some other entity. We're really looking at all avenues at this point.
And just to discuss a little bit about these issues that each tenant is having within their home, for example, while it started off with a gas leak, one of the issues with the fire department being there is because of the electric heaters and the possibility that it may catch on fire. Well, we've heard from a number of tenants that they've experienced issues where the wall sockets become hot, the wires become hot. There are issues even with the electrical system. So while it may seem easy to just say plug in an electric heater and that may keep someone warm, that even places them in jeopardy. So the problem when you have a complex that you've just let deteriorate, you haven't put any money back into this asset, you have people who are living in a ticking time bomb. No matter what they do to try to survive, it subjects them to another danger. And that's the whole premise behind habitability, is the fact that their home, this place where they're supposed to be secure in, is a place of danger because it's not kept up to standard and code.
And so has there been conversations with the owners?
Not between the three of us, myself, Alexia, and John, and the owner. At this point, we are learning just what everyone else is hearing through the media, that the owner has not really made any public statements to the best of our knowledge. So we have not been able to reach out, although we have tried to reach out to the owner's attorney.
Correct.
And we have not heard anything back yet.
Okay, and this has been going on for 3 weeks. This crisis has been already in for 3 weeks.
Correct.
Okay, so that seems pretty extraordinary.
I would like to add that something that was said when he stated it's like we were living at home, like a refugee situation. I think to myself, if this was an apartment complex on Champlain and Perrin, would we allow this situation to get this bad? Would we allow this situation, these people, to live in this type of situation? And so we have to examine that as a city. What can we do for our community as a whole, not just community that can afford to live in standard habitability apartments, but our community as a whole, making sure everyone's taken care of? We should see the situation as something that is not acceptable for any person living within our community.
Well, and we know that there has been, you know, like you say, you've been doing, folks have been doing tenants' rights kind of work here for quite some time, and there has been, you know, pretty broad discussion and debate about the need to have the code enforcement go out and, you know, make sure that these, you know, residents are habitable. So what's the role of the city in this crisis?
The city, as far as code enforcement, I mean, everyone knows, well, I shouldn't say everyone knows, that's part of the problem, is code enforcement is supposed to be the agency that is there, and when folks have issues with housing, they're supposed to be able to contact code enforcement. I've talked to at least a couple of the tenants residing at the apartment complex who've had frustration with dealing with code enforcement. They've made several phone calls to code enforcement, to summarize what they are telling me is that they have been put on the back burner. We don't know at this point whether or not there's language, again, issues. If there's an issue with folks at the apartment complex not knowing about code enforcement, not knowing their rights, which is a lot of times we see with tenants that is the case. They're just not knowledgeable about their rights. But I can safely say right now that there is a disconnect between services that the city has to offer and the community in general, and this is a prime example of that.
I can say that for code enforcement, we do know just on a budget standpoint that we reduce the amount of code enforcement officers that we have. We used to have a substantial number, then we reduced it down to the bare minimum. Now they're speaking of a pledge to increase the code enforcement officers. But during that period where we're down to bare minimum for code enforcement, how are they to enforce all of the areas where we're talking about slumlords, which are quite a few in Fresno? That's just not acceptable. We need more code enforcement officers. This is a task. This is a war on slumlords, and we need to treat it like that. Also, just from my experience in dealing with another case that I have, which is the Fresno Inn case, that one code enforcement came in on multiple times, but it never had the teeth, the bite, the administrative proceedings to bring the slumlord before the court and actually make the findings that needed to happen through the code enforcement administration. It was only until there was an actual gas leak and people had to be relocated that code enforcement came in and did the condemning of the units.
I guess one of the things that I don't really, you know, I've been reading the media and I'm like, you know, kind of confused about the whole thing, quite frankly. I guess one of the questions that came to my mind is, if it's a gas leak, why wouldn't PG&E be responsible for fixing it? And what's PG&E's responsibility here?
That's certainly a question that I think the three of us, meaning the three attorneys who are involved in this case at this time, we've got a lot of questions. And I can say that we also want answers. We haven't been provided those answers, I think. Times when we've wanted to participate in some of those meetings, we've been asked to leave. So we certainly have questions, too. And what we're learning is through the media, just like everyone else.
Mm-hmm. Have you guys, I mean, I don't know if, you know, you're representing specific clients. Have you guys, like, tried to contact any of these entities? Or
right now, this is a process where we have so many tenants that we're offering, number one, the information as to the tenants' rights. And if they want to, then they can come on and sign for representation. And the next process is actually just to start the filing of a lawsuit in order to make sure that these people have the representation, and that will give us the access to the discovery, because right now we're as much of an outsider as everyone else when it comes to being privy to the information of how much notice did this landlord have regarding fixing this pipe with PG&E. Did PG&E inspect it ahead of time and tell him to fix it a month ago? Those are all issues and information that we need, but that is afforded during the discovery process. So that's why our main concern right now is making sure that we provide this education to the people, getting the lawsuit in, and then getting access to the discovery.
Mm-hmm. Is there any kind, I mean, since this is a potentially life-threatening situation, we're talking about babies, we're talking about elderly people, I mean, what is the provision to deal with that? I mean, and to really, I mean, you're talking, you know, we all know the legal, I mean, we can be here 5 years later, you know, going through blah blah blah. Was it PG&E's fault? Was it this person's fault? Was it that person's fault? But what's right now? I guess legally or any other politically, any other way. How do you deal with, you know, something that's a life-threatening situation? Do you want to talk on?
Yeah. It's the managers, not the landlord. It's the managers. They didn't provide to other people. To the land, he don't tell to the
tenants,
the owners.
Uh-huh.
He's the managers. He don't say nothing. Okay, it's not the landlord. It's the managers that we pay bills to the managers. Not the he don't tell the owners what really actually happened in that complex.
That's the way you see it.
Yes, it's the managers. He's the managers.
And who's the manager?
I believe it's a gentleman named Jerry Vang.
Yeah.
And there's, again, because it's been, the Somerset apartments have been there for a very long time, and so they've had a number of different managers, but I think currently the current manager is Jerry Vang.
Yes.
I do want to go back to what you mentioned briefly. I was out there yesterday to drop off a few blankets for the residents there at Somerset. And I have to say, the community has really come together. I am so proud of our Fresno community. I saw the amount of donations that came in, and certainly they need more donations. But I'm really proud of our community for stepping in. And in this type of situation, I think the city is doing what they can. We are trying to do what we can legally, but just the community support, I think, that has poured in, that's been very uplifting.
So what exactly has been done and what's still needed?
To my knowledge, I talked to someone out there, and about 300 electric blankets are being donated, and they should be arriving next week. Folks in the community have donated food, jackets, which I think is much needed. So if anybody out there that's listening has jackets from their children or that they have that they're not using and can donate, that would be great. Blankets at this point. They're not taking any electric heaters, which is what I was told, because there is an electrical issue over there.
And then, of course, FIRM, the organization and ministry that is assisting everyone in kind of coordinating the efforts, always financial support, because they can take the funds and decide how to use it for the community, whether it's food or blankets. They monitor the need. So definitely financial support on FIRM.
Okay. So basically community support is available in terms of an immediate remedy, but we don't know of any legal remedies that are quicker than winding through the courts for the next several years?
I can answer this question because of a prior case that I had, and this goes into dealing with the legislature. There are codes that state that if there is some type of hazard condition where code enforcement believes that an apartment should be shut down, that the owner is to actually pay for relocation fees. It actually states that the owner is to pay for relocation fees within a certain period of time, and if they do not provide those relocation fees within, I believe it's 24, 48 hours, then there's actually a penalty assessed, and the amount of relocation fees is the standard amount of HUD housing within that neighborhood. Our problem, we went to court to enforce this on our other case when the people were displaced and practically homeless. Well, the issue is that there is no immediate enforcement through the courts to make this provision have teeth. So we went in under a TRO system, for example, to ask the judge, please do this on an emergency basis. The judge stated, I would love to do this on an emergency basis. However, of course, you know we cannot provide money on an emergency basis legally. There has to be some other provision in that code that states there's some way, if the landlord does not pay up within the 24 hours, if the penalty is assessed, something that can be happened, whether it's taking over his assets, liquidating them to get the relocation fees when he decides not to pay within the 48 hours. But that has to do with the legislature actually taking a look at that particular
provision. And that would be state legislature?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Okay. Anything else that we... So we do, it seems as though, and you guys are in this business, that this could be the tip of the iceberg here in Fresno. We have a lot of slum, not maintained apartment complexes, right?
Yes, correct.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
This is just one of many slum landlords here in Fresno, and this case just happens to be on a very large scale and in the media, and it just happens to have a lot of impact on the residents and the community, and we're now aware of it. But Fresno itself has many slum landlords, and we need to be aware now of the issues. Tenants need to be aware of their rights. They need to assert those rights. They need to educate others on their rights. And it's my hope that this case will allow the people of Fresno to have that communication on what tenant rights are and to hold landlords accountable. In my experience representing tenants, sometimes you run into a situation where a landlord has one property, and unfortunately that landlord just is not educated on his responsibilities, not because he wants to be a slum landlord, but he's not educated on what he has to do. So this case hopefully will open the eyes to landlords as well.
And why don't we've got a couple minutes here, just real quick. What are some of the things that tenants, what do tenants need to be on the lookout for? What are their rights, and what is the best way for them to defend them?
Well, understand that if you pay rent, that there is an obligation of the landlord to keep your place in a habitable condition. Habitable means that it's free of dangers. For example, you should not be living with cracked windows. You should not be living with mold. You should not be living with holes in your wall or doors that cannot lock. Things of that nature. There's a whole list of conditions which could create a dangerous situation. But what they want to do is write a letter to their landlord. Put it in writing. Ask for those repairs. Send it to your landlord. Keep a copy for yourself. Send it certified mail to your landlord. Then give your landlord a reasonable time to make repairs. And if your landlord does not make the repairs within a reasonable time, contact a tenant's right organization or a lawyer for assistance. That is your right. A lot of people do believe that they may not have this right either because of their immigration status or because they simply were not raised to believe that they have these rights. But it's important to educate that if you live in an apartment and you are paying rent, you are entitled to rights.
Okay. Thank you very much. Gone, Nathada, Pahualo, and Alexia Kirkland for joining us and sharing this information. Is there a phone number or website or anything people can go to?
They can go to my website if they like to. It's www.pclorlaw@gmail.com. My contact number is on there, and then I can put you through to Alexia and John if necessary as well. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very, very much. You've been listening to Street Heat, our monthly celebration of the struggle for workers' rights and social justice. I'm the host, Pam Whalen. Mike Rhodes is on the controls. And now we're going to take you back to the KPFA Evening News.